As Election Day approaches and early voting has begun in some states, including Illinois, what are voters thinking about their choices?
Our polling shows a pretty good showing for the Democratic candidates. I mean, Hillary Clinton's 53% in the race for president. Tammy Duckworth is ahead of Mark Kirk, 48-34 in the Senate race.
That's David Yepsen of the Paul Simon Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. He joins us to talk about the first release of its fall 2016 poll of Illinois voters. We also talked to a Chicago musician who's raising money for sexual assault victims in the Champaign-Urbana area, and the artist behind a national exhibit in Central Illinois that chronicles a tumultuous relationship between the U.S. and Central American countries.
This exhibit kind of helps people realize that these places continue to exist and continue to struggle in different ways.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Early voting is underway in Illinois. Election Day is a little over a month away. Coming off last night's vice presidential debate, we wanted to take a look at what voters in Illinois are saying about their choices, not just for national, but state office. The Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University has been talking to prospective voters about all things political, not just, of course, the big presidential race, but about how Illinois voters feel about where their tax dollars should go, how they're feeling about Governor Rauner and House Speaker Michael Madigan, and a host of other issues. David Yepsen is the director of the Institute. He's on the line with us now from Carbondale. Hey, David, welcome back to the 21st.
It's good to be with you.
David, let's start with some new information that you all released this morning. It pertains to voter sentiment in Illinois about taxes, term limits, and redrawing legislative maps. And in fact, a majority of voters that you all polled support all of those things. Let's start with taxes. What kind of taxes are voters look interested in us doing a better job of as a state?
Well, the big issue is gas tax. There's a constitutional amendment before voters for what's called a lockbox that says you can only spend gas taxes on road things. And 80% of Illinois voters said they are for that. So that looks to be in pretty good shape for approval.
And, of course, because the Illinois Supreme Court has not allowed it, voters don't have a chance to express their views on how legislative maps are being drawn. But the Simon Institute has been polling this question for a decade. What did your most recent survey find about what voters think about redrawing legislative maps?
There are 72% of likely voters in Illinois who say we ought to have a redistricting commission, an independent commission, drawing these maps and not legislators. That's a record. It's always been high, but it's 72% is landslide proportion. Only 18% oppose the act.
Can we switch to national politics for a minute? I can't but ask you, as a veteran of observing so many different presidential campaigns, what did you think about last night's debate?
Well, I thought Mike Pence won on style points. He just looked the part. He looked presidential. He's got to defend a candidate who has got a lot of negatives and a lot of baggage. But, you know, Senator Kaine just had too much coffee or something, because the whole business of interrupting somebody and stepping on their lines, you know, that can be effective once in a while. But he was just constant with it. It was really kind of hard to watch Kaine's performance because he was just so hyper.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was painful. There were so many points where both of them were interrupting that you really couldn't understand anything anybody was saying.
No, and the moderator was just helpless to try to stop him. I mean, it's like a couple little kids arguing, and let's have a grown up here in the room. So Kaine did not do Hillary any good. The thing is,
Does it matter? Right. The question is, right.
It doesn't. Vice presidential debates have never really mattered. And today you're hearing some chatter already in the pundit class about why do we even have these things? They don't matter. They're sort of a distraction. So I don't know. I imagine there'll be some talk in the future about not even having a vice presidential debate.
That's an interesting thought. When we think about the political fact that we look at the state of Illinois and we think about where, obviously, we've had in recent years, a very clear tendency of Chicago being Democratic, Republicans doing better in more rural areas downstate. Where do you see the battleground in Illinois in this election cycle for the presidential race?
I think it's in the suburbs, in the Chicago suburbs and in the collar counties. And the reason I say that is, in the old days, those were primarily Republican. They're trending more Democratic now. So you have a situation where Democrats do well in Chicago still. They're doing better in the suburbs, and they do lose downstate, but there aren't that many voters downstate anymore. So it's our polling shows a pretty good showing for the Democratic candidates. I mean, Hillary Clinton's 53% in the race for president. Tammy Duckworth is ahead of Mark Kirk, 48-34 in the Senate race. And, you know, even in the controller race, which is a pretty obscure race, Susana Mendoza, the Democrat, leads incumbent Leslie Munger, the Republican, 40% to 32%. So this is a good finding for Democrats. Now, it's important to remember that we went into the field with this the day after the presidential debate, which nationally Hillary Clinton is enjoying a bump of support. So this may, in fact, be a little bit rosy for Democrats because they were coming off a debate in which she did well, Trump did not do well. So I think you have to take it with a grain of salt. But now the polls are not predictors. They're a picture of where things stand at a given point in time. And I think right now, Illinois, it's been a Democratic state. Looks like it's going to continue that pattern.
And given that they are a picture of a given time, can you just give us the details of how many voters you polled, when you polled them?
Yes, we were in the fields from a week ago, Tuesday, yesterday, until Sunday. We polled 1,000 registered voters. About 850 of those said they were likely to vote. So these numbers have a plus or minus of 3.3%.
Margin of error.
The thing we really tried to do in this poll was to reach out to cell phone voters. We have 60% of our respondents are cell phone users. That's a high number. Pollsters are going to have to start doing that. The census says 60% of the people in Illinois use cell phones. So that's what we were really trying to do here in this poll, is get a reflection of that. And we did.
I'm speaking with David Yepsen. He's the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. Over the past few days, the Institute has just released its first set of fall 2016 polling. And David, you were just talking about Hillary Clinton leading the Democrats in general. Not really a surprise, Democrats leading in Illinois. But about 10% of the people polled said they don't know who they're voting for in the presidential race. Is that common? So close to a presidential election that you still have 10% of the people that you all polled who said, I don't know yet.
I think you get a segment of that in any race, but particularly this one. Lots of voters are struggling with this choice. We have two major party nominees who are the most unpopular nominees their parties ever field. So we're going to elect the most unpopular president we've elected in recent times, no matter who gets elected. And you also have the specter now of even the libertarians who had great hopes for Gary Johnson are seeing him sort of melt down with this confusion over who's a great world leader he admires, and what is Aleppo. And so you have a lot of voters who are saying, I don't know what I'm going to do. It's a month out. There's a couple more debates. So a rational voter who doesn't know what they're going to do might say, yeah, okay, I don't know yet. I'm going to think about this. But it's also true, and I think particularly in this race, that there'll be a lot of these undecided voters who simply don't vote.
That's what I was going to ask. How many people just do you, and I guess you don't, I don't know how, you said you do poll people about whether or not they intend to vote. What are the numbers looking like for people you polled if they said they're even going to show up?
Yeah, we had in the high 70%. It won't be that high. This is the great challenge pollsters.
Right, because people say they're going to vote even though they're not going to vote.
People say they're going to vote even though they're not. How do you build a model and a question that tries to get at whether they're going to show up? So we had a lot of people tell us they were going to vote, and we know darn well that they won't.
Let's talk about the U.S. Senate race. You mentioned that Representative Tammy Duckworth, who's facing off against incumbent Senator Republican Mark Kirk, that she's leading right now. How big of a lead does she have, and where do you see that going?
Well, it's 48% for Congresswoman Duckworth and 34% for Senator Kirk. Republicans have known that this is going to be a very tough race for Senator Kirk. He won in 2010, which was a good Republican year. This is 2016. It's a presidential year in Illinois. That's bound to be a good time to be a Democrat. Senator Kirk has been slowed by his stroke. He just can't wage the sort of campaign that he has waged in the past. So I think you take those factors, and plus there are a lot of conservative Republicans who really are not happy with Mark Kirk.
Well, and I was thinking, yeah, Senator Kirk was actually on the program last week, and he was talking about his efforts with he has an Abuelitas program he's been working on for 10 years, helping secure short-term temporary 30-day visas for grandmothers and for families over the age of 50 who want to visit their Mexican-American relatives here in the U.S. And I was talking to him about immigration and talking about the tone that he has and asking him if he thinks it would hurt his chances with Trump supporters. And he just said, you know, I don't really care if it hurts my chances. Well, he didn't say that. He just said, I think that whether or not it hurts myself with Trump supporters, this is the right thing to do because this is reflects the global nature of Illinois. But I can't help but wonder how that may affect him with Trump supporters.
I think it does hurt him. I mean, I admire Senator Kirk for having the courage of his convictions, and we need to have more politicians that do that. But the hard political reality, and you look at the conservative media in Illinois, they don't have time for Mark Kirk. They're unhappy about this, that, or the other. And so he is running as a Republican in a tough year for Republicans. At the same time, he's got a lot of conservative Republicans who are lukewarm to outright hostile to him. So I think he's in a difficult position here.
Let's talk about state races, particularly, obviously, Republican Governor Bruce Rauner is not on the ballot. But let's talk about approval ratings for Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan. What is that looking like right now?
Well, in the race for who is the most unpopular leader in the state,
right, unfortunately,
Speaker Michael Madigan has a disapproval rate of 63%. Governor Rauner has a disapproval rating of 55%. So both are a majority of likely voters in Illinois don't like either one. President Cullerton in the Senate is pretty unknown, and he has a 41% disapproval rate. So he's just not as well known as the other two players.
David, what does that look like in terms of historical context and disapproval ratings in Illinois for the speaker and for governor?
This is the worst for both men. We've not polled a lot on Michael Madigan in recent cycles, but he used to be maybe 55% unpopular. Now it's 63% disapproved. So his disapproval ratings have bumped up. And so have Governor Rauner's. When he took office in 2015, voters was about a third approve, disapprove, and don't know. Governor Rauner's disapproval rating has grown steadily. Last year in the spring, or this earlier in the spring this year, he was at 50% disapproval, 41% approve. Now he's at 55% disapprove and 40% approve. So both Rauner and Madigan have trend lines of growing unpopularity. And is it any wonder? I mean, the race for the legislature in many districts is simply a battle of trashing one another with an incredible amount of television advertising. And, you know, so-and-so is Rauner's proxy, so-and-so is Madigan's proxy. And that's just bound to drive up the disapproval numbers. And finally, you know, the state's budget is a mess. The state is a national joke, and this stalemate is having real world consequences on people. And so it's to be no surprise that voters in Illinois are pretty angry at their leaders.
That said, how much do you think this will play out in the comptroller's race? You mentioned this a minute ago, and I want to go to that. It's not often that people are paying so much attention to the comptroller. A lot of people, I think, don't know what a comptroller does, frankly, but I wonder how you saw the polling of that.
Well, and you're right. There are 24% of the likely voters who, you know, they don't know what they're going to do. It's an obscure race. Some people think it shouldn't even be elected. We should have it merged with the state treasurer. But it's one of those races that sort of tells you what the partisan feeling is like in a state. That people don't know either one, so they kind of vote their party, vote their preferences. And Susana Mendoza, the Democrat, has 40%, and Leslie Munger, the incumbent, the Republican who was appointed by Governor Iyer, has 32%. So 40-32 with 24% don't know. The race could go either way, but right now it's leaning Democratic.
And is your sense, you think, that with that race in particular, everyone sees this as a proxy for Rauner and Madigan? Do you?
In a sense, they become pawns, if you will. They're like chess pieces in this battle between the two leaders and the two parties. I mean, Governor Rauner is contributing a lot of his own personal wealth to his party and to its candidates. Democrats would dearly like to pick up the controller's race because that seat, you know, it is obscure, but it does say things like, here's when we're going to write the checks. And I think Democrats could have a lot of fun with Governor Rauner if they controlled the state controller position.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with David Yepsen. He's the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. We're talking about their most recent poll that has just been, they've been releasing over the past 2 days, their most recent polling of Illinois voters. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is David Yepsen. He's director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. We're talking to him about their polling that the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute has just released. They're based, of course, at Southern Illinois University. David's on the line with us from Carbondale. David, when we are talking about the budget, we've been talking about Illinois' fiscal mess and how people feel about our leaders. And when we spoke with people earlier this year, many of them expressed disappointment about their party's lawmakers, and they said that in the past, maybe they would have voted all straight Democratic or straight Republican, but this year they're going to be looking more closely and maybe being more selective. Do you get a sense that that might be more common this year than others, or do you think that this is going to play out in state House races?
No, I think there are so few competitive legislative races that I expect the Democrats will control both the House and the Senate after this election, as they do now. The big question is whether Republicans can pick up a few seats in the House of Representatives in order to deny the Democrats a working veto-proof majority. And so that's an open question. And there are some races where Republicans and Governor Rauner have targeted Democrats in conservative rural districts. We have a couple of them down here in Southern Illinois that are represented by Democrats. And Republicans think they have an opportunity there to pick them off. And they're spending, both sides are spending record sums in a handful of those races. But frankly, most voters in Illinois really don't have much choice. They live in a gerrymandered district, so it's either safe for the Republicans or say for the Democrats.
And that, to that point, David, of how few competitive races we have, do you think that is because of gerrymandered districts? Why do you think it is that there's so few competitive races this year?
Well, yes, is the short answer. When you have gerrymandering, when legislators pick their own district lines, you have a situation where the majority party, and both parties have done it, you have a situation where the majority party draws lines favorable to their members to protect their incumbents, to try to hurt the minority party. And so you wind up with a lot of safe Democratic districts and a lot of safe Republican districts. And that leaves most districts that don't really have a serious challenge for the legislature. They have either the opposition party is not even running a candidate. If they do, it's only a token opponent. There aren't very many open seats that can be more competitive. And so you wind up with a situation where we've got maybe a dozen House seats that have any kind of contest at all in them. But and it all goes back to, gerrymandering. Politicians are picking their district line.
David, as you all are releasing this first set of fall 2016 polling for the Simon Institute, did any of the results surprise you?
It surprises me the Democrats are doing this well. And I, as we mentioned earlier, we went into the field the day after the first presidential debate, which Hillary Clinton did well in. All of the national polling shows that. And I think we may be reflecting this here. I think Democrats, things are not over with here. Tammy Duckworth may lead Mark Kirk 48-34. But the other way for Duckworth to look at this is, 52% of the electorate is not with her. So it's too early to use this poll to make predictions about an election a month away.
And that said, what do you think will be the main issues here as Election Day draws closer?
Well, in the race for president, it's all about who you dislike. Many of these races are personality driven, and particularly in a race for president, it's not an issue checklist so much as it is how you feel about an individual. Both Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, very unpopular. It's very difficult for a lot of voters. And I think in a dozen legislative races around the state, it's very much whether you want the Governor Rauner running the show or whether you want Democrats and Speaker Madigan and President Cullors. It becomes the proxy war, if you will.
David Yepsen is the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, online with us from Carbondale. David, I know you have a couple, for people who are really the political pundits who have not gotten enough here, you guys have a couple events in Chicago going to be going over all these polls later on in the week, right?
That's right. On Thursday, we meet with the City Club to review these poll numbers. We've also got some other polls that we're still collecting, analyzing the data. And I think some of those are going to be interesting, how many people are thinking about moving out of Illinois. What is the impact of the state budget crisis on people? So those are things that, they're not hot election issues, nevertheless, but I think they're important to the state.
Certainly very important for the state. So we'll be talking to you about that when those come out. David, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. We've heard time and time again about how the state budget impasse is affecting social service agencies around the state and how services for women have been hit especially hard. That's why one Illinois musician, Emily Blue, is making an individual effort to help keep the Rape Advocacy, Counseling, and Education Services Center operating in Urbana. You just heard a bit of her song, No Pain. We're joined now by Emily, who's on the line with us from Chicago, to talk about what she's doing to help raise money for the agency. Emily, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We just heard a little bit about your music. How did this project come about?
Well, this project was actually not supposed to happen because I was working on a LP called Heartlines with just a bunch of pop songs that I had written on my own. But I just sat down one day and started writing about rape culture and some of my experiences just in my life, and realized that I had more to say about that probably than anything, because I had never really written about it and I never taken the time to explore my own feelings. So then I wrote, maybe like 5 or 6 songs surrounding the similar themes, and I was like, I think I have a record here.
Wow. And so it sounds like a lot of this was about help you finding a voice for something that maybe you haven't voiced before.
Yeah, I would say that sexual assault is something that is extremely hard to write about, especially from a first-person perspective, because you don't want to overshare, you don't want to misrepresent anything that you know that a lot of other people experience also. So I think that the challenge was presenting it in a way that was authentic to me, but also acknowledged that this is a universal experience. and not trying to step on anybody's toes in that way.
And was that a little bit about where the idea for this album came about?
Yeah, I think that the album is all about my relationship with womanhood in our society and also with other women. Like, there's a song called Lavender on my record that's sort of about my mom and my best friend, Fiona, who inspire me all the time. And then there's a couple songs that are a little bit more painful to listen to that involve, you know, the downsides of being a woman in our world today.
Well, I wonder if we can hear a little bit more of that song that we just heard, This Is No Pain.
When I bleed, you don't feel no pain. You don't feel no pain. You don't feel. When I bleed, you don't feel no pain. You don't feel no pain. You don't feel.
We all know just how this works. You distance yourself from the things you've done till no one hears the truth in my words. They're running away from ruin. Oh, 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 I have apologized too many times. I think I'm starting to unwind. Watch me.
That's No Pain. The artist is Emily Blue. She's on the line with us, and we're talking about this album that she wrote. It's part of an effort that she is making to help fundraise for the Rape Advocacy Counseling and Education Services Center races operating in Urbana. Emily, the music video for this, we're going to tweet out the link so everyone can see it if you follow 21st Show. But the music video of this, I think, is so powerful because you have different messages from other survivors who are sharing their stories. How were you able to reach out to people and get them to share those stories for you?
Well, I am an avid user of Facebook, so I just posted a lot of statuses requesting survivors that were willing to come and share maybe a short testimony. I didn't give very much detail on the first couple of statuses because I just wanted to gauge people's interest and comfort levels with the idea. But it turns out that I got a lot of responses, almost so many that I thought we were going to have too many for the video, which is amazing that people are brave enough to come forward. But I also wanted to let them know that they don't have to talk about the pain involved in these experiences. They can also talk about how they've healed as individuals and how they've found empowerment after, you know, whatever trauma or pain they've experienced in their lives. So if you watch the video, you'll be able to see that some people chose to give encouraging words, especially towards the end of the video. Some people are talking about phrases or giving phrases of empowerment that they think of in their healing process.
Emily, how did all of that affect your other work on the album?
I just realized how important it is to give survivors a voice at all, because so often in our judicial system and just in our culture, we silence them every day. And that's one of the reasons that the rates of sexual assault are so high, is because it's this taboo subject that we can't just come out and say, hey, 1 in 5 women are assaulted in their time on their college campus, and then the rates are even higher for trans or non-binary individuals. So I just wanted to give some visibility to people.
The donations from this album, you've raised more than $4,000 so far, and the album hasn't even been released yet. It's going to go towards helping RACES, the organization we've been talking about, keep their doors open and their phone lines up. Why was it so important for you to be fundraising for this organization?
I just know personally, as a student of the U of I, that organization is extremely important for survivors, and it's full of really amazing people. Some of my friends volunteer for that organization, and we have to have we have to have races at our campus. It's very tragic that our budget crisis is affecting them in that way, because it's a very necessary resource. So I thought that with the response that I was already getting before putting this album out, I thought I would make the whole record nonprofit, because I have the ability to do that as an artist. And I didn't feel, it didn't sit right with me to imagine myself making any money off these topics that are so vulnerable and so important for people.
When will the record be released?
It comes out on November 4th, and there's a release show in Champaign at the Accord that night.
And where can people help continue to donate to the project if they want to?
They can't actually donate through Kickstarter, since Kickstarter closes its doors after the funding date. But if you buy the record, any profit from that record is going to go straight to races.
And Emily, for you, do you think this is? Do you think the project will continue after this album is released? And I'm thinking in particular of all of the voices that you collected, all of the people that you heard from that we were talking about. That's in the No Pain out in that video.
I really hope that this project gains momentum. I didn't expect for it to have. I just didn't anticipate any response, really, because primarily I work with a band called Terra Terra, and that's my main project, and it was my main creative outlet. But I would really like to tour on this record, and I would really like to reach as many people as I can. I'm putting out some videos eventually, and I'm just really excited to see what happens.
And what did you learn about yourself from working on this?
I think I learned that people are listening to me, and that I have the ability to say really important things. As a pop musician, I had this idea that my music has to be kind of watered down and cookie cutter, at least with the more produced style, like what you hear on the radio. There are often really, cliche themes that they use, and it's just not, what they're saying is not new, and it doesn't really resonate long term. So I learned that anybody that is making art has the ability to make a positive change in the world, and I really wanted to do that with this.
And do you feel that not just the people that you were making the art, but I guess also the people who helped you make the art probably also experienced that?
Yeah, definitely. The No Pain video shoot especially comes to mind, because there were just so many people from different backgrounds. I didn't know most of them at all. I was meeting these people for the first time in a super vulnerable situation where they were being filmed and asked to talk about one of the hardest things to talk about that there is. So I think that there was just this shared understanding that we're going to get through this together.
That's Emily Blue. She's in Chicago. She's, as she's mentioned, this is a solo project she's been doing. The album is called Another Angry Woman. Let's take a listen to one final song from her album. This is called Your Heartbeat Is. Emily, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Listening to the 21st. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking to artists from the Borderland Collective. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The relationship between the U.S., not just our government, but our businesses, and many Central American countries has a long history of conflict. And how that conflict plays out in present-day relationships Even, I mean, people, including children who are showing up at the U.S.-Mexico border, is the subject of the Northern Triangle exhibit in Champaign at the Krannert Art Center. The exhibit started in West Texas. It's been in Chicago. It's going to go on to the University of Arizona in Portland. It's the first traveling exhibit by the Borderland Collective, and two of those artists, Jason Reed and Mark Menjivar, are in studio with me now. Mark, welcome to Illinois. Jason, we should say welcome back because you're an ISU grad. Thanks for being here, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Jason, I wonder if you can start with the idea for this exhibit, because it started a couple years ago, and I'm thinking about numbers in 2014 where we saw more than 68,000 unaccompanied minors coming across the U.S.-Mexico border. That's when you guys started thinking about this.
Right. In 2014, we did see about 68,000 plus thousands more, you know, into hundreds of thousands of people coming. And so there's a big discussion happening. What should we do? Should we secure the border more? What's actually happening? And a lot of it was like political dialogue that was superficial. And so Blue Star Contemporary Museum in San Antonio reached out to Borderland Collective, who has a history working with community and building dialogue around issues, and asked us to build an exhibition or programming to create like constructive discourse around the issue. So we kind of entered Blue Star and created this exhibition that looks back kind of at larger histories of U.S. involvement in the region and why are young people coming up now. It's not just a thing that's happening in contemporary terms, but historical terms.
And when we think about that, part of the exhibition, both of you are photographers. Part of this includes photographs, Jason, you took of a trip you did with U.S. Border Patrol. And there's a photo you have of drag tires. Can you explain why you took that and why there are these drag tires that are being dragged across on the U.S. side of the border?
Right. It kind of relates to, it's a surveillance technique. So you think about drones and binoculars and all of these cameras that are on the border. But really one of the most effective techniques is dragging tires along a road right along the river, right along the border. And by dragging the tires, you smooth the soil. And then if somebody steps on that, they can come by and say, okay, we know somebody's been here. We know where they're going. And it's sign cutting. It's an ancient technique. It's like related to hunting, which I think the language around that is really interesting. You think about like hunting people and
but they can actually even, you were saying Border Patrol agents can even tell by the size of the shoe.
Exactly.
The age of the person. They can tell by the print of the boot what part of Central America maybe they came from, what country they came from.
Right, where the shoes come from, like maybe how tall they are, how much they might be carrying. So they could distinguish maybe is it like a group of young children or is it people carrying heavy packs that might have drugs in them. And so they use that as, you know, intelligence and also like, what direction is it pointing, where they might be going.
And you juxtapose this, right, because you have photos that are from the actual Border Patrol from their Flickr page, and mm-hmm. they have this very robust Flickr account. What do you think of those images? Why do you think that there are so many of them?
Well, it's part of the PR campaign. It's the propaganda wing of the Border Patrol, and the Flickr is like this way to get the images out to the public in an easily accessible way. They're government photographs, so they're high-resolution downloads, so anybody can use them for any purpose. So as I make my own pictures, I've also then gone on the Flickr and archived pictures that they've been making as a way to like provide a counter. So I'm making pictures of them, and then I'm looking at how they're making pictures of themselves. And then I also work with young people on the border, and they make pictures of the border. So it's like these three ways of looking at the same space. And then so then you start to understand the kind of complexities of that landscape.
We're talking with Jason Reed. He's one of the two artists we have in studio from the Borderland Collective. And it's part of an exhibit. It's called Northern Triangle on display right now. And one of our 21st team visited the exhibit, producer Sean Newman. He created a little postcard so those of you listening can experience a bit of it yourself. Let's listen to his postcard.
I'm Amy Powell. I'm curator of modern and contemporary art at Krannert Art Museum. And this exhibition is by a group called Borderland Collective. based in San Antonio, and it's called Northern Triangle. The exhibition takes a format of a kind of loose timeline. There's an ankle bracelet along with an advertisement for ankle bracelets. If there's not enough room in a private prison in Texas for an asylum seeker, for instance, they may be made to wear an ankle bracelet while they await processing. And then we come through to a long wall all about mostly El Salvador in the 1980s and U.S. intervention there.
My name is Gracia Grimaldi. I'm a first-year graduate student in social culture anthropology. I'm from El Salvador. I mean, I didn't, like, grow up during that time, but my parents did, my grandparents. I also studied in National University, which was a political center during the war. And you walk through the halls of the university, and the memory of the war is there.
My name is Ellen Moody. I'm an associate professor of anthropology here at the University of Illinois. This exhibit kind of helps people realize that these places continue to exist and continue to struggle in different ways. They just don't, until recently, didn't kind of get back into the news. And unfortunately, when they get back into the news, it's violence again.
So this is a song called La Bestia that was commissioned by U.S. Customs and Border Protection in 2014 to warn people in countries of the Northern Triangle about the dangers they would encounter if they took this crossing, to try to deter them. So that's the song that reverberates, that talks about how dangerous the trains are and how long they take. Hanging on the rail cars of this iron beast, migrants go as cattle to the slaughterhouse. It's one excerpt from the song.
Northern Triangle is on display at the Cranard Art Museum at the University of Illinois until December 22nd. The troubling exhibit is by Borderland Collective. Two of those artists are in studio with me now talking about things. They're here for a couple of events, actually, that are going to be happening on the U of I campus for the next couple of days. Jason Reed is with us. Jason, you're going to be doing a lecture tomorrow evening about all of this, right?
Yes, at 5:30 at the Cranard Art Museum Auditorium. We're going to be doing a talk. Myself, Mark, Adriana Corral, who's an artist that's part of our collective and in the show, and Erina Dugan, who's an art historian, we're all going to be sharing our research and work and then having a conversation with the audience.
Mark, we were just hearing about El Salvador in the postcard. You grew up in not just El Salvador, but in Nicaragua and Panama, because your father was in the U.S. military during all of the time, a lot of the historical context of the most sort of the past couple of decades of the most kind of tumultuous events we know of Central American countries happening. How much did your family's background and you, sort of your life experience as a kid, how much did that lead to you becoming an artist?
Well, I think that background has definitely shaped who I am as a human being. I'm also a licensed social worker, and that's what I started off, studied in school. And then from social work, that led me into the arts, I think, out of some frustration with the profession. But especially the work here in Northern Triangle is deeply affected by it. My grandparents were from El Salvador. They came to the United States in 1944. My father was born on U.S. soil in 1945, making him the only U.S. citizen in our family. And then, as you mentioned, I mean, he was a colonel in the U.S. Army, and we lived throughout all of those countries. And so as a child, I was experiencing those firsthand, and particularly in El Salvador, living there during the Civil War from 88 to 1990. And those years deeply formed me and shaped me and led me to want to go back to El Salvador later on in 2009 to begin working with a community that I've been working with for the past 5 years.
And let's talk about your childhood for a minute, because growing up as the child of it was a very much an expat life, but then also your father was a colonel, the highest ranking in terms of the army when you were in El Salvador. He was one of the highest ranking.
The military group commander, yes. Mm-hmm.
And so how do you think your childhood, it probably as a kid, it doesn't seem weird to you, the lifestyle that you have because you're a kid, but maybe in retrospect, you living under that living during those times, there were some things about your life that you realized probably weren't
definitely,
normal.
Definitely. And I spent the first 5 years of my life here in the United States. I was born in Virginia. So when you go down and there's bombs going off and there's attacks on a regular basis and you're having to be swept away from school because of threats, I mean, you know that that's not normal. But I think at the same time, I was there with my parents. And so it was normalized in a way because I wasn't just completely isolated from it, but we were in bulletproof cars with bodyguards. I mean, at all times for that.
Well, and you were telling me a story before, as a kid, being a teenager, if you're going to go to an arcade, they had to do a security sweep of the arcade before you got there. And it's a really interesting perspective you have, because I think it took you maybe some time to realize that you were in a place of really unique privilege in all of that.
Definitely. And I think it wasn't – in some ways, you mentioned that as a kid you don't really realize it gets kind of normalized. But when I was in my undergraduate education and began to really look at U.S. involvement in Latin America through the Jews is when I really became aware of that and started to face some of those issues. So, looking at my own life in conversations with my dad and realized some of the troubled history that my family was definitely a part of.
And some of those objects have ended up in the exhibit. Can you tell us about some of those?
They have. My father has been really kind and generous in entering into dialogue. And I think when I was first realizing some of the things historically that I had problems with, I was pretty angry and it kind of came at him. And he really would sit down and enter into dialogue with me and ask me deeper questions. It really required that I listen to his perspective as well. So I really appreciate that and I have a great relationship with my father. And as we began working on Northern Triangle, he very kindly turned over his personal archives to me. So all of his papers from our time living in Central America, and allowed us to use whatever we wanted inside of that to help add context and another layer or another voice to some of those historical events.
And Jason, one of the things about this exhibit is that there are there's archival news reports from a long time ago, but it's almost as if the things that they're saying, it's a little bit of, I don't want to say history repeating itself, but there is a cyclical kind of nature to these things. Was that intentional for you guys, that you wanted to have that as part of the exhibit?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as we started working on the exhibit, I think those things popped up to the surface rather quickly. And part of it, you watch the news in 2014 when the story was on all the major news networks. And then you go back and watch the news in the 80s, and it's the same story. Tom Brokaw in the 1980s talking about the surge at the U.S.-Mexico border of Central Americans. And you could have turned that on, and it would have been 2014. And so the circular narratives that come out, I think, are really important. They talk about our history repeating itself, that kind of cliched phrase, but I think it's really true and important. But also I think by looking at the circular narratives, we might imagine what's possible in the future, and that those things could change through dialogue, through action, through some of the programming we're hoping to do, is that those things don't have to be inevitable.
Mark, some of this now, this art has led to another project you're working on called Migration Voices. Can you explain a little bit? You're doing an oral history compilation.
Yeah, Migration Stories. And so, as we were building this exhibition and thinking so much about not only our own stories of migration, but talking with people in the community who were coming, it really led me to begin to think about creating a space to value those stories, to value those narratives of looking at where we come from and how we've arrived at where we are, because we all have migration stories. Some of them are just closer than others. For me, it was my grandparents coming. For others, it may be families coming in, 1800s, and some people are just coming today.
And you, on Friday, are going to be compiling stories. You're asking people to contribute those stories.
I will. We will be on campus from 12 to 5 working in the quad. And it's really nice. Every time we've worked on migration stories, I've worked with people in the local community the day before to do a workshop to really talk about oral history and do a training of how to record those. And then with those people from the workshop, we then go the next day and record and invite people to be a part of the project.
Where are you collecting these stories? All over?
We started in Chicago. So this is the second iteration of what we'll be doing in Arizona, Portland, Kentucky, and then, of course, in San Antonio. We're working on a model that will be inviting people that have crossed themselves to interview other people that are here.
What do you want people to take away from this? What kind of conversations do you guys want people to have when they see the exhibit?
I think for me, I always think about having multiple entry points and multiple exit points. So I think everybody's going to come away with something different. But I think that so much of where the meaning is located is where you can find a place to hang your own story. And we were just talking about migration stories, but it's about realizing that it's not just something that is just them over there, but these are our neighbors, these are our family members, and we're all involved in this situation.
That's Mark Menjivar. He's an artist with the Borderland Collective. I want to thank Jason Reed as well for joining us again. They've got events all week. We'll have that up at our website. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for today. We've got some special bonus content on our website. One of our producers, Christine Herman, who also has a PhD in chemical biology, explains to us the chemistry behind the Nobel Prize winners that were just announced this morning. One of them was Sir Fraser Stoddard of Northwestern University, and the Nobel Prize was for his work on molecular machines. Christine explains all of that to us if you head at our website, www.21stshow.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day.